calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live, coast to coast, border to border, here on this beautiful Monday, the 15th of July, of May. Hey, we just changed the date even. David Thibault is with us, Thibault with CNSNews.com, www.cnsnews.com, Cybercast Newscast, the conservative news website. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom.
I understand you've got a burr under your saddle about left-leaning professors writing Bush's history.
Yeah, people who you would consider to be right in line with your ideology, but it turns out that 83% of these college professors who were surveyed ranked President Bush as either a failure or below average. Now, I'm not going to support Bush policies across the board. We can get into individual policies if you'd like, but it turns out that a USA Today Gallup poll, which was taken at about the same time, indicated that there was 63% disapproval among the American public. Now, what do we make of this? Well, there's a 20% gap, first of all, indicating that liberal professors are holding sway on college campuses because they're 20 points more inclined to consider Bush a failure than the rest of the American public.
Or it could be that most of the American public don't pay really much attention to politics until 6 months or 6 weeks before the election, whereas professors of history are paying attention to politics on an ongoing and continuous basis.
I think, in fact, it's there's some truth definitely in what you say. For example, this year people are not going to pay full attention until Labor Day because it's not a presidential election year. But I think a lot of the academic ideology is present in the day-to-day establishment media news coverage. So you're getting it as an average American, I think, double-barreled. You're getting it from academia.
So
you're getting it from the establishment press that Bush is a loser and a failure. And that's got to influence a lot of the American public.
Well, let me ask you, David Thibault. First of all, am I pronouncing your last name wrong?
Yeah, but you get a lot of things wrong, Tom, so that's okay.
Tell me how to pronounce your last name.
It's pronounced like T-E-B-O.
Yeah, that's what I thought, Thibault.
T-E-B-O.
Yeah, okay.
Tell
me, David Thibault, do you think that George W. Bush is a failure as a president?
In some ways, yes. Certainly.
Okay.
Are you
a liberal?
I'm not.
Okay, then what's the problem here?
Because in some ways he has succeeded beyond, I think, a rational person's expectations.
So, but overall, would you rate his presidency a success or a failure?
No, I would not consider President Bush's presidency thus far to be a failure. You would consider
it a success?
In the larger sense, I would say that he has been successful.
Okay. And so you're suggesting that this, well, first of all, you just made the comment a minute ago that all of this is proof that the media is liberal. NBC.
Academia, especially.
Yeah. And that they're getting their information from the liberal press. I noticed that NBC did not even mention, not once on the air, for a full 6 weeks after the Downing Street memo became public. It was a screaming front page headline in the newspaper that Rupert Murdoch owns in London, the Times of London, arguably the New York Times of the UK, screaming front page headline that the president had already decided he was going to go to Iraq back when he was telling the American people that he wasn't going to go to Iraq, that he had already planned it, and that he was fixing the intelligence.
Right.
Actually, here's Bush on this.
You said
thing.
We're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
He's the decider. But we know now from the Downing Street memo that he was lying to us at that time, that he had already decided to go to Iraq, and that they were fixing the intelligence, that they were rigging the intelligence to
Have you seen the Downing Street memo, Tom?
I've not the original. I've seen certainly a printout of it. Have you?
Well, do you think possibly that it's been somehow doctored, that, that maybe NBC considered it flimsy, and that's why they didn't jump on it the way
No, because the day after it was printed in the Times of London, the Jack Straw came out and said that it was accurate.
Jack Straw did not concede that all of the elements that have been publicized by Joe Wilson and some others were accurate.
The Downing Street memo had nothing to do with Joe Wilson. It had to do with a meeting between George Bush and Tony Blair.
Well, Joe Wilson has used the Downing Street memo, along with the anti-war left in the U.S., as a club on which to beat Bush and the Bush administration.
My point is that you know, if NBC is going to ignore this for 6 weeks, they're going to the entire media right across the board. They were handmaidens in getting us into this war. They've been giving Bush a pass all along the way. I don't buy your contention that the media has a liberal bias to it. But a larger question that I think, David, would be a useful one for you and I to discuss is, what does liberal mean and what does conservative mean?
Right. Liberal means that there's a socialist underpinning to everything that you see.
And what does socialist mean?
Socialist means that government knows better than the individual.
So then government in the United States is we the people. And as Thomas Jefferson said, I do not trust my future to the rich. I will trust my future to the people. So what you're saying is that liberal means that those of us who trust in the will of the people, those of us who trust in democratically elected institutions, the liberals, are that. Okay, now conservatives, you look at Russell Kirk's book, The Conservative Mind, 1953. This was the book that got Barry Goldwater and everybody else really going. It still is the basic Bible of conservatism, lays out the six basic tenets of modern conservative thought. And number three, civilized society requires orders and classes. So the conservative notion is that there should be a conservative ruling elite, rather than the people making the decisions. Would you grant that?
Well, your reference to we the people is an idealized version of government. We know that government doesn't work that way. And when you trust in government to handle education, to handle everything else that can be and should be dealt with at a local level, then you get incompetence, you get corruption, you get misspending.
So you'd rather have Dow Chemical teaching our science classes and McDonald's serving the food in the cafeteria?
No, of course not.
We have McDonald's serving the food in the cafeteria right now as a consequence of conservatives intruding themselves into our education
system. McDonald's makes a product. They're entitled to pitch their product. And if we societally decide not to eat their product, then they'll change what they make.
Well, if Dow Chemical, a corporation, isn't going to be teaching us about chemistry, and government is not going to be teaching us about chemistry, who is?
People at the local level, Tom. You're assuming that nobody at the local level knows anything.
And those people at the local level organize the teaching of chemistry in that school through the institution, presumably, of a school board, and at the very least, correct?
You're assuming
yes or no, Dave.
That all wisdom emanates from Washington.
No, I'm not. I'm absolutely not. I'm totally in favor of local control for education. And that local school board is government.
Well, that local school board is government, but that's at the local level. You're not talking about Washington controlling everything.
I'm not in favor of Washington controlling everything. I'm the last person to be in favor. I think that No Child Left Behind is a disaster.
Well, then we agree on something. But see, that's not...
But the Bush administration, the conservatives, the Republicans, they want Washington to be controlling everything. They even want Washington to be knowing who I'm talking to on the telephone.
No. No, the idea of tax cuts, for example, is to empower people, individuals, and local governments. It's to get the money out of Washington so Washington doesn't spend too much and waste too much.
I see, and it's worked really well, hasn't it? The spending
it
in Washington has really gone
well
down.
As it should. Tom.
It hasn't worked at all, David, number one. And number two, they're not tax cuts. They're tax deferrals. You and I are going to have to pay, or our children are going to have to pay the money that George Bush is borrowing right now from China in order to give so-called tax cuts to millionaires and billionaires. You think that's conservative?
Extent, I agree with you, Tom. I think that the tax cut policy is excessive. I think that there's a very good commentary in today's Washington Post, actually, that lays it out. I don't think that the tax cuts should have been cut. The taxes should have been cut as much as they were, but I do believe to some extent in trickle-down economics and supply-side economics. And
when has it ever worked anywhere in the world, David?
Well, it works in combination with other things, and you've got to consider that.
Name one country.
The United States.
Oh, our economy is really good now.
Our economy is very good now.
Okay. All righty. David Tebow, CNSNews.com. Thanks a lot for being with us, David.
Anytime, Tom.
Good conversation. It's 16 minutes past the hour for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be right back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
3 chicks came from Texas with a banjo and guitar and a fiddle that could make you cry or set your soul on fire. Their mamas taught them to speak up about what they thought was true, and they thought their country gave that right to them and me and you. Now one night back in England, one of these babes brought up a beef about how she wasn't too bewitched with her commander-in-chief. Some folks did not appreciate how she denounced their man. These patriots rolled up their sleeves and took matters in hand.
Let's meet all the Dixie Chicks. We're too nice to use rocks and sticks. So let's demolish their CDs with a bulldozer or whatever you please.
If this reminds you a little bit of bonfires in Berlin, well, cowboy, that just goes to prove it can always happen again.
And welcome back. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. Our telephone number, toll-free across the United States, 1-866-440-8466, 440-THOM. Drop into our live chat room at tomhartman.com. However you spell it, we'll get you there. And just click the live chat link. It'll drop you in. What has become of the real conservatives, the real American conservative? Today's so-called conservative agenda is fundamentally about ownership and the power that comes from it, as opposed to the traditional, and you just heard David, you know, laying this out, as opposed to the traditional American ideal, the liberal ideal, that democracy is the foundation of our government. Democracy is the foundation of our country. That when we, the people, get sufficiently active in our government, then our government works. And instead of sitting around and saying, oh, well, you know, we know that the federal government doesn't work particularly well and that they're not responsive to our needs, therefore we should privatize our schools, therefore we should privatize our fire departments, therefore we should be privatizing our army, as we have the second largest army now in Iraq is private contractors, therefore we should be creating opportunities for you know, having McDonald's be serving lunch in schools. I say nonsense. I say no, let's make our democracy work. If our democracy is not working well, then let's fix it. Let's not say, oh gee, it's broken, let's just abandon it. That just sets us up for a theocracy or a corporatocracy, or both, because the theocrats and the corporocrats, or fascists actually, are always willing to get into bed with each other. Always. Hitler had an official Reichsbishop, Pastor Müller, the official Reich. He at least had a good grace to commit suicide at the end of the war, at the end of World War II, when the Reich ended. But this is the conservative notion, that it's all about ownership, that it's not about democracy. And there are a lot of things that the founders and framers of the Constitution, the founders of this country and the framers of the Constitution, believe that we, the people, should own. And the most important of them, of those commons, is our government itself. And whenever you hear conservatives say, well, you know, it's government isn't really working, it's really not responsive to the people, therefore, you know what's coming next is, therefore, there's an opportunity for me and my buddies to make some money. And it's, for example, this is from the New York Times today, article by Eric Lipton. The Department of Homeland Security has invested tens of millions of dollars. Now, notice tens of millions of dollars. countless hours of labor over the past 4 years on a seemingly simple task, creating a tamper-proof identification card for airport, rail, and maritime workers. It's called the Transportation Worker Identification Credential. Tens of millions of dollars. Problem is, it hasn't come into being yet. As Eric Lipner writes in the New York Times, instead, the road to delivering this critical anti-terrorism tool has taken detours to locations, companies, and groups often linked to Representative Harold Rogers, a Kentucky Republican, who is the powerful chairman of the House subcommittee that controls the Homeland Security budget. See, this gets back to this core idea that if you don't believe in government, you can't govern. If you simply see government as an opportunity to make your buddies rich, then you're going to have the kind of disasters that we had in Katrina, you're going to have the kind of disaster that we have in Iraq, and you're going to have the kind of disaster that we have with this tamper-proof ID card for transportation workers. As Eric Lipton writes, it is a route that has benefited Mr. Rogers. This is Harold Rogers, Republican from Kentucky, creating jobs in his home district and profits for companies that are donors to his political causes. The congressman has taken 11 trips, including 6 to Hawaii, on the tab of an organization that up until this week was to profit from a no-bid contract that Rogers helped arrange. Work has even been set aside for a tiny startup company in Kentucky that employs John Rogers, the congressman's son. You get it?
Our government is broken. We need private companies to be doing these things, especially those owned by Republicans.
This is the most corrupt administration in the history of the United States. And it is being enabled by a conservative philosophy that says democracy is not what we're all about in the United States. Government doesn't work. You shouldn't trust government. After all, government is a them. And don't think about fixing it. Don't think about going back to the ideals of the founders and framers of this country. Don't think about going back to the idea that maybe we should actually have a participatory democracy. No. Do away with government. Make it smaller. And replace it with Republican Harold Rogers and his corporation that's giving him campaign contributions and taking him to Hawaii 6 times and that's employing his son. After all, that's what it's all about. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. A place where being progressive never felt so good. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Going back to the whole idea of, you know, what is conservative? Who are the cons? What are they up to? What's the plan? How do they think of this? Where are they going with all this? Well, you know, they also, in addition to the agenda of economic elitism, they also have a serious concern about minorities, as Michael Savage shared with his listeners on his radio program last week. Let's go back to the beginning of this.
What will it take to wake you up to the fact that you're being erased from the future of America, and why are you being erased?
You being white people in the United States. No, I kid you not.
If you're a person of European descent, why do they want your child to be a minority in America?
They? Oh, it must be those liberals, you get it.
And when your little girl is a minority in America...
Our little girl.
What will happen to her? Tell me, what will happen to her? Do you think that the minorities, when they take over this country, will be quite as benevolent as an enlightened and as enlightened as the European Americans are today?
Last I looked, Bill Richardson, who's Hispanic, is doing a pretty good job running New Mexico. I don't know.
Or do you sense that just perhaps, just maybe, they will not bring the learnings of the Magna Carta, the Bill of Rights, to their new power.
Interesting. So let's see. People who are African American or people who are Hispanic Americans, people who are Asian Americans, people who are Native Americans, because their ancestors didn't come up with the Magna Carta, which, by the way, only provided rights to rich people. Michael Savage says we better be careful, and he's pretty explicit about this. He continues.
But logic dictates that if one out of every two children under the age of five is not white, that within a very short period of time, whites are being erased from America. Now, when whites become a minority in America, tell me what you think is going to happen to your grandchild. Do you think that the people who are now minorities, when they seize power, when they are the senators, when they are the congresspeople, when they are the president and the vice president, do you think they'll be quite as enlightened as our liberal government is today?
Well, as a matter of fact, gee, thanks for the tip of the hat to the liberal government there, Michael Savage. But a lot of those, you know, Mel Martinez down in Florida. I mean, are you saying that Jeb Bush's wife is a threat to democracy? Isn't it amazing that the cons not only listen to this stuff, but lap it up?
And treat the minorities, meaning then the whites, as fairly as the non-whites are being treated today? I don't. I do not.
So this is the be afraid of those brown people argument. This is the hair hysteria that's being whipped up in advance of Bush's speech tonight. Tonight Bush is going to say, as the answer to every problem in Bush's world, I mean, this is the abused child syndrome. The answer to every problem is to hit, is to use the military, is to take out your guns. And so he's going to say, okay, what we've got, the problem with the border has nothing to do with the fact that we don't enforce laws making it illegal to hire aliens in this country. Instead, it has to do with the fact that we don't have enough guns on the border, so we're going to get the National Guard down there. Yeah, right. And Savage continues.
Why and who is behind erasing the white person from America's future? I ran into a friend of mine, Captain Phil, at the gas station today. He had the same exact answer that I do, because it will be a more malleable population when the Europeans are diminished.
Yeah, it'll be more malleable. Last I looked, Bill Richardson really wasn't all that malleable. He really knew how to take names and kick butt. But, you know, in Michael Savage's world, on the one hand, when Hispanics or Hispanics and African Americans in combination represent the majority of Americans, and that demographic will probably happen in about 20, 30 years. In Michael Savage's world, when that happens, on the one hand, they will be ferocious and violent toward whites, and we all us white folks ought to be afraid. Speaking only for myself, I realize many people listening to this program don't fall into that category. And secondly, they're going to be more malleable. I guess, can you have it both ways? I guess so. And then Fox News, John Gibson, he comes out and he does an op-ed piece on this. This is you know how they have editorial announcements? This is John Gibson with his word, his minute.
Now it's time for my word. Do your duty. Make more babies. That's the lesson drawn out of two interesting stories over the last couple of days. First, a story yesterday that half of the kids in this country under 5 years old are minorities.
Yeah, in other words, have more babies if you're white. We can't just, you know, the Mexicans are having a lot of babies, but we can't let that happen while they're pulling their weight. Let's give them credit. But no, we can't let that happen because civilization is at risk. If there aren't more white babies, don't you get it? Yeah, John Gibson will explain it to us.
By far the greatest number are Hispanic. Know what that means? 25 years and the majority population is Hispanic. Why is that? Well, Hispanics are having more kids and others, notably the ones Hispanics called gabachos, white people, are having fewer.
Oh, the gabachos. Us white people, we're not having enough babies. Or is it that the Hispanics are having too many babies? Maybe you should have a conversation with the Pope, John Gibson. But anyhow, he continues. He goes through a whole thing about how Russia is going through negative population growth, and Putin's starting to pay a bounty on babies and, you know, helping families to have babies. And then he summarizes this way.
Put it bluntly, we need more babies. Forget about that zero population growth stuff that my poor generation was misled on. Why is this important? Because civilizations need population to survive. So far, we're doing our part here in America, but Hispanics can't carry the whole load.
No.
The rest of you get busy. make babies.
You white people.
Put another way, a slogan for our times, procreation, not recreation. That's my word.
And, you know, but only pay attention if you're white, which, of course, is the majority of the viewers to Fox News. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Patricia in Sacramento, California. Hey, Patricia.
Hey, Tom. Hey, Tom, I had an opportunity this past Friday to go to an event where Mr. Pratap Chatterjee, who is the president of Corporate Watch.
Yes.
And
he's been on this program.
Yeah, he's really incredible. He went into great details about his studies on, I don't know if you knew this, but he owns a share of stock in Halliburton, which is great because he gets to go to these Halliburton meetings. I think they're out of Oklahoma. And he gets to get more details than, say, someone else would.
Not to mention the fact that he's seen the value of his share go up, and he gets a dividend check every 3 months.
Yes, exactly.
Which he pays a maximum 15% income tax on.
Yeah. It was really interesting because he went into extreme details about, this is for those conservatives out there who claim that if you privatize everything, you know, we won't have these problems that we're having. But it's just all the wasteful spending, Tom. And starting with Halliburton, I don't know if a lot of Americans knew this, but were you aware that they are housed, the employees are housed in five-star resorts? And I think he said that it was built there, and it was costing at least like $10,000 per employee.
Right.
You know, for the rooms. I mean, you should see it has he has pictures of this.
That's right. Five-star resorts on paid for with your tax dollars and mine.
Yes, and while our soldiers are making, what, $1,800, $2,000 a month, they don't have the equipment they need, you know. But we know that part. But the interesting thing, Tom, I don't know if you knew this, he mentioned Corporate Watch was able to get a hold of this report before it was changed, the Defense Contract Audit Agency audit report.
Mm-hmm.
And on there, what he talked about is Halliburton had had asked the government to redact a report that was showing that they were accused of overcharging fraud.
Right.
And so if you see the report now, it has it all omitted out of there. But I just thought that was interesting because that started from the beginning that these guys were, you know, doing this for quite some time.
They're, yep,
you know,
yep.
It's a normal practice.
Nothing new. Nothing new.
Unbelievable. I mean, things like, you know, I don't know if people know this, but the oil being imported into Iraq from, now I think some of it's Iran, but Saudi Arabia, they were actually importing oil. You know, what the price they were charging to do that, you know, the money they're making on this, they're billing the government for so much, but yet they've only spent, you know, less than what they were billing for. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Yeah,
but it's
the conservative way, Patricia.
But isn't that interesting that conservatives don't seem to complain about this?
No, not only do they not complain about it, they're enthusiastic about it because they own stock in Halliburton. They're making their dividends, and it's being paid for by the taxes of working people like you and me. And they're very happy about it. They don't view government as we the people. They don't view it as us. They view government as either a dark benevolent force, that is when we the people try to assert our authority, our power, and say, gee, maybe we should do away with the health insurance companies and just let everybody have Medicare. And stop messing with Medicare by you know, with a stupid drug plan that says that the government can't negotiate with pharmaceutical companies and the drug plan is actually administered by private companies, and instead simply have Medicare do it. No, then it's a dark force. But on the other hand, when it's paying for the rebuilding of Iraq through Halliburton, then it's not a dark force. Patricia, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate your getting out there and showing up. The Corporation Watch, a great organization. And this just, it really highlights the difference in the conservative and the progressive or the liberal or the traditional American worldview. Basically what I would say is there's the traditional American worldview that goes all the way back to George Washington, that government is us, that it is government of the people, by the people, and for the people, to paraphrase Abraham Lincoln, that it is we the people, to quote the first three words of the Constitution of the United States. Now, on the one hand, there is the classic American worldview, and on the other hand, there is the conservative worldview. And the conservative worldview says, No. It's not we the people. That's a them. That's a terrible thing. That's the government elite. Yeah, right. That we voted into power, the government elite. And conservatives run that government elite now, and so they're breaking it so that they can say, see, it's broken. We broke FEMA. Guess we should do away with it. Let's just make it Bechtel, Inc. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends, to the vast liberal conspiracy. Take no imitations. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. 9 minutes before the hour, 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan, listening on WTKG. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Well, I heard the tail end of your conversation with the guest earlier in the hour and talking about federal government, you know, getting out of our lives, which usually means federal tax cuts. But I can see a very direct impact this eventually has on communities like Grand Rapids, Michigan, because when the federal government is bankrupt as it is, you know, has such an imbalance in their accounts, they say, well, we can't do such things as revenue sharing to help the states and the cities.
Right.
And by the same token, the state of Michigan is also in that same position. They cannot help cities like Grand Rapids. And our city commission right now is dealing with a very severe budget crisis. And one of our commissioners keeps saying that the state of Michigan should help us with revenue sharing. Well, the problem there is the state of Michigan is also in relatively bad fiscal shape. So what happens is, and this is what the conservatives say, and they sort of do have a point, that it ought to be the local governments that finally take the bull by the horns and deal with this. But guess what? They don't have the guts, certainly the commission of Grand Rapids doesn't, to raise taxes. So what do? We have three swimming pools, Tom, in Grand Rapids, six of them. Our city manager wanted to close all six down, but the city commission says, no, we'll open three of them. And these three swimming pools that are closed are actually new, but they can't be used. We don't even have all the restrooms in our city parks open last summer. I don't know what they plan this year. We've got some amateur baseball in Grand Rapids. Last year we couldn't have that because the city could not take care of the baseball parks.
Yeah.
And this kind of nonsense just goes on and on.
And the way the conservatives will respond to this, Rick, is they will say, well, you know, the city shouldn't be in the business of providing swimming pools and restrooms and parks and things. Instead, you should have membership-only country clubs, and you should have pay toilets, and you should have parks that are owned by Disney, and you should pay $10 to get into them. And if you're rich, you're just fine. And if you're not, hey, we didn't want you in our society anyway. That's the conservative worldview.
Would you have private police eventually, too, then?
Oh, sure. Sure, absolutely. I've been in communities when I was working down in Colombia, in Bogota, Colombia. I mean, they still have a national police force. They still have a city police force. But most communities, most of the communities where people are upper middle class and above, and basically there's not much of a middle class in Colombia. You're either poor, and it's mostly working poor, or you're, you know, the upper end of the upper middle class, and then of course there's the fabulously wealthy, a very small number of people who are basically control the country. Those upper middle class neighborhoods have their own private police forces, and you see these guys walking around, you know, with their machine guns 24/7. And a lot of those guys are also cops on the side. You know, they're drawing two paychecks. But yeah, they've privatized their police departments, and a lot of wealthy communities in the United States have as well.
Isn't that actually how I forget if it was the SS or the SA under Hitler? Wasn't one of those originally his private?
Yeah, the SA.
Okay, they were like his private bodyguards, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
So people think, you know, privatizing everything is the solution. Well, there's a good example of something that was private that wasn't so great.
Well, and it's the direction that Bush is moving the current SS, the Secret Service, as well. But that's a whole other discussion. Rick, thanks a lot for the call.
You
make a great point, and I appreciate it. Derek in Woodbridge, Virginia. Hey, Derek.
Hey, Tom. Going back to your previous guest, he said that trickle-down economics has worked in the United States, and I just want to say that's, you know, baloney.
To be charitable.
You know, if you go back to the beginning of trickle-down economics with Reagan, consumer, corporate, and government debt went through the roof.
Yeah, yeah. And it didn't work. They covered it up by borrowing.
Exactly.
That's the bottom line. And now the chickens are coming home to roost from the borrowing. You've got a flight of capital from the United States today, the news talking about, well, you know, oil dropped over the weekend, gold dropped over the weekend, shows that the market's going to come back. I don't think so. I think it's some profit taking. I think that the market will take a breather for a day or two, and probably it's a, you know, for investors, it's probably a good day to be buying gold or platinum, you know, or stocks in those areas, or oil stocks or whatever. But the bottom line is this country is so bankrupt and the rest of the world is figuring it out that it's just absolutely scary.
Yeah, and if you go back to the 1960s when our tax policy was with corporations, they were about 50%. With the upper top income brackets, they were at 91%, and our annual average growth rates were double of what they are now almost.
Well, they were solid. They were absolutely solid. Yeah, they're double what they are right now.
They were at like 4.3%, and now it's at about 2.8%.
Right. Yep. Good point. Good point, Derek. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Pat in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hey, Pat.
Hi, Tom. My obsession lately is with the Constitution. It seems to me that when we first went to war with Iraq, that this administration led the people to believe that we were fighting for the Iraqi people to have democracy.
No, not true. What they said when we first went to war was that we were fighting to protect ourselves from being attacked by a government that was going to hand nuclear weapons or other weapons of mass destruction to terrorists who wanted to harm us. That's why we went to war.
That's true.
And that is a constitutionally lawful reason to go to war. Go ahead.
The point I wanted to make is I want people to think that if we went to war to also bring democracy and give them a constitution, wasn't it supposed to be reflective of ours?
Well, you would think so. You would think that if we were going to shed American blood, it would be for American ideals. But the Iraqi Constitution says that any laws that conflict with Islam are no longer laws, which is the same thing the Iranian Constitution says. And we claim that Iran is part of the axis of evil because of that. Go figure that one out. We'll be back after the break, after the news at the top of the hour here, with more. I have just an incredible ABC News story for you about why they're listening in. 57 minutes past the hour.
Listening to the Tom Hartman program, check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, probably the earliest and most famous of the examples of it in the modern era, in the lifetime of many of us, was Barry Goldwater versus Lyndon Johnson. Lyndon Johnson running an ad of a little girl picking the petals off a daisy as a nuclear bomb goes off in the background. It only aired on network television once, period. But sort of like the Swift Boat ads, developed an enormous amount of negative or of publicity for the negative message it carried, which was that Barry Goldwater would blow up the world and Americans thus voted for Lyndon Johnson. David Mark is with us. DavidMark.org is website. Going Dirty, The Art of Negative Campaigning is new book. David, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you here with us. What's the main purpose of negative campaigning?
Well, it's often to drive down voter turnout. It's not really to raise the positives of somebody's own candidate, but just to show how bad the other person is and keep people away from coming out to vote for them on election day.
Now, to that effect, Paul Weyrich is famously the father of the Reagan Revolution, he calls himself. He's called himself a number of things over the years. He's a direct mail guy. I don't know if you want to add anything to his bio here before I play this clip.
just that he really is a founding father of the social conservative movement, and he's been very influential over the years.
Yeah, there you go. So here's Paul Weyrich. He's speaking in a church to a group of Republican activists, this is just 25 seconds, laying out his philosophy of it speaks for itself.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome, good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
So the purpose of negative ad campaigns is to do exactly what Paul Weyrich is talking about there, which is driving down the number of people who show up at the polls. Bottom line.
Right. He actually said it out loud. Usually political strategists are not quite that open about it. They won't usually say openly that they want to drive down voter turnout. He was just willing to go a step further.
I don't know that he knew that he was being recorded. I mean, he was speaking in a church to a group of activists, and it got out, shall we say.
Sure.
It wasn't a televised speech or anything like that. So you go through the history of attack ads. I thought one little caveat in your book was particularly interesting. Was it in New Jersey? The guy was Gucci sticks in my head. That's not how it's pronounced though. I probably even have the state wrong. The guy who ran the ad saying that the guy who was opposite him, who was running against him, the Democrat, was in favor of rape on campus. And this thing blew up in his face.
That's right. This is Felix Grucci. He was a one-term congressman elected in 2000. He was facing a tough re-election fight in 2002. His Democratic opponent had been a college provost most of his career. And there had been some unfavorable newspaper articles about him about crime statistics on campus. But this guy Grucci took them way out of proportion and actually said the guy he was running against was soft on rape and not very sympathetic to crime victims. And clearly this didn't square with the facts, and it completely backfired on Grucci. And he ended up looking basically like a jerk, and he lost his reelection bid.
But reading that chapter, I got it that Grucci was quoting from a newspaper that had not just retracted the story that he was quoting, but gone to the trouble of sending people out to collect every single copy of that particular edition of the newspaper on the newsstands and bring them in and destroy them because the story was so wrong. And yet he quoted the story anyway. And so the Democrat just simply, used that fact and beat him about the head and shoulders with it. The fact of the matter is that usually negative campaigning isn't that badly handled, isn't that clumsily handled, and therefore doesn't backfire, isn't it?
That's right. Most campaigns do their homework more than that, although you would be surprised how many folks really do not vet their candidates thoroughly. They don't look at the charges and facts that they're putting out there. And this kind of incident happens more frequently than you might expect.
Now, we have a situation from the election of 2004 where it wasn't even a campaign that was funding this thing. Most of the initial money for the Swift Vote Veterans for Truth came from one of the five Walton heirs, one of the billionaire Walton heirs, and from a Texas oil man. And they didn't seem to have, I actually had I'm forgetting his name now, but the guy who was the co-author of the book and head of the whole thing on this program, in fact, twice. And it just seemed to me that they didn't really care much about the facts. They just wanted to get their words out there, and they figured, well, the facts will clean themselves up later after the election. We don't care about the facts.
Well, that's right. I think you're probably referring to John O'Neill, the head of the Swift Vote Vets for Truth, a couple of years ago. Whether those ads were factual or not, it was almost irrelevant. They just wanted to get their message out there, throw a bunch of mud at the ball, and see what stuck.
Yeah, and why? Negative campaigning is not something new, and there is, a history of people when negative campaigns are inappropriate or over the top of people fighting back and actually turning the negative campaign against them. Why did John Kerry wait weeks? And my recollection is it was something like 18 days before he responded to this thing.
That's an excellent question, one that will probably be with him and his campaign staff for years to come, if not the rest of their lives. It's really an open question why they didn't respond. I think it was kind of like Michael Dukakis back in 1988. They just figured that people would pass such charges, they wouldn't believe such outlandish accusations, but some people did, and it just shows you can't sit on your hands. You have to fight back.
Yeah, and when you do fight back, I would guess that probably the reason why Bob Schrum and all these other, brilliant Democratic strategists who just over and over again seem to be responsible for Democrats losing elections, but I guess that's a whole other discussion. The reason that they didn't want to respond is because they were concerned that responding would give credibility to the allegation.
That's right. But in this day and age, with cable news networks 24 hours, the internet, blogs, anything is going to get out there, and it has to be responded to. It just it doesn't make sense to me why they pursued that strategy.
Yeah. So what's the future of negative campaigning here in the American body politic? And to what extent is it a cancer that should be excised? Or, on the other hand, to what extent is it like the proverbial itch that is warning us of the bug that's going to bite us kind of thing, or something like that? You know, something that actually, even as obnoxious as it may be, is something that we probably should keep around. I mean, the negative campaigning goes back to, you know, John Adams was running campaign ads basically saying that Thomas Jefferson was sleeping with his, well, he wasn't, they weren't campaign ads, he was funding a guy publishing the stories in the newspaper, sleeping with his, with Sally Hemings.
That's right. There's absolutely nothing new about this. And in many ways, campaign tactics today are more civil and genteel than they were in days of old. Going forward, I think we're going to see negative campaign strategies become more and more individualized, tailored to individual voters, which campaigns really can get that information now based on voting histories, mortgage records, car and magazine purchases, and they can create these really specific voter profiles. And I really think negative messages are going to be catered to individuals. Now,
do you mean they're going to cater to individual voters? So if I'm a voter who happens to make more than $60,000 and I own a Chevy Caprice or whatever, then they're going to come after me and say that my opponent hates people who make more than 60 grand and who drive General Motors cars. Whereas if I own a Toyota and I make under 40,000, they're going to say my opponent hates people who drive Toyotas. That kind of thing.
Well, it may not be quite that specific, but what I mean by that is they'll try and see the issues that you care about. There might be something in there that lets them know you voted or you were active on an educational bond issue. Therefore, that's going to get your dander up. Maybe you were in a hunter's club and you're going to care about gun rights.
Right. Well, that's the thing. I'm a member of the NRA, so I get all kinds of – but most of the stuff that I get is actually pro-Republican candidates – and occasionally Democrats, very rarely anti, although it's been, we haven't seen a big campaign for a while.
Mm-hmm. Well, each interest group, each campaign does it a different way, but I really think it's going to be based around those kind of issues.
Yeah, so they will be individualizing them in the context of the voter.
That's right, and I also think we're going to see national security continue to be a big issue going forward.
Right, you have a chapter in your book, Going Dirty, The Art of Negative Campaigning. We're talking to David Mark. We just have a few seconds left, David. You have a chapter about the sale of fear. This is the next big thing?
That's right. Ever since the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks, political campaign commercials have compared opponents to Osama bin Laden, Saddam Hussein, other kinds of nasty international villains. And I think we're going to see a lot more of this going forward, although I question how effective it's going to be, because I think people are starting to get a bit tired of it.
So Willie Horton wouldn't work in today's environment?
I think that viewed as rather mild and milquetoast the way we're going.
Yeah, the Willie Horton ad. Yeah,
right.
Amazing. David Mark, davidmark.org, the website, the new book, Going Dirty, The Art of Negative Campaigning. David, thank you for stopping by and sharing your thoughts with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Great talking with you. It's 16 minutes past the hour. Truth and common sense in broadcasting for a change. I'm Tom Harkin.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Tell me, George, if there's any damn way that there'll ever be a day I can get on a plane without worrying about the next maniac trying to pay me back.
Just because you're half insane.
You're half insane. Right-wing freak judges, $200 billion grudges. Yes, war's cooked up right from day one. Big corporations are running this nation like it never was meant to be run. Yes, George, I hope you're having fun.
And welcome back to the radio support group of, by, and for We the People of the United States of America, the Tom Hartman radio program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, M-A-C-S, 1-800-511-MACS. And tell them Tom Hartman told you to call. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service on the line, talkradionews.com. Hey, Victoria.
Well, hey, Tom, I can tell you that, as you know, the president is going to be speaking about immigration tonight at 8 o'clock Eastern, and his press secretary, Tony Snow, assured us this morning that the president cares very deeply about this issue, and there are four principles that he'll be speaking about, and they are border security, interior enforcement, the temporary guest worker program, and assimilation. And the other thing he wants us to know is that the White House has been having ongoing talks with the Department of Defense, and there are two important guiding principles that we need to know about there, and that there's going to be nothing here to compromise the ability to fight the war on terror, and at the same time, to maintain the ability of the National Guard to respond quickly and effectively to national disasters. And I'm sure that you feel better now.
I certainly do, Victoria. Thank you so much. I'm assuming that probably nobody asked the question, but it seems my take on this is that Bush does not want to put money into the Border Patrol because those are good government jobs with pensions and union membership, and therefore he will drag the National Guard down there up until November when the election's over to look like he's doing something.
Well, perhaps as close as anyone came to asking a question with such effrontery. were questions along the lines of what exactly is temporary.
Right, right. Temporary is until November 7th.
Right, and temporary being kind of nebulous, and that question was asked, and we were assured that that would be revealed to us.
Interesting.
Tonight.
Now, ABC News is reporting...
I have it in front of me as we drive, yes.
Yes, that one of the reasons the Bush administration wanted all those phone records was so that they could start checking on reporters to find out who the reporters are talking to inside the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, et cetera, the White House, to be leaking information. So if you work for the government and you have been providing information to a reporter and you've ever used a telephone to do it, you should be afraid, be very afraid.
Yeah, unless you're doing what sensible people do when they're leaking, which is you use a payphone.
Right, or you do it from your office, but you do it to out a CIA agent. If you're doing it that way, then the president will actually defend you.
Or you do it in an underground parking lot.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, actually, to go back to All the President's Men, yeah. So
it's very disturbing. I mean, it really is quite extraordinary. And the thing about this is, if they'd wanted to do this, did they really need to get the information from 200 million Americans to target a small number of journalists?
Well, it's the perfect way to do it without having to get a FISA warrant and being able to claim that there's some reason for it. I mean, they wanted to know who you're talking to, Victoria Jones, but they didn't want to have to. They knew that if they went before a court, the court would require probable cause, some proof that a crime probably had been committed. They don't have that, but they want to know who you're talking to. And so this way they simply sweep up everybody and then just kind of ignore everything except you.
And so then, you see, then if they want to try and establish patterns, they somehow have to show that this is relevant to the war on terror.
No, they don't. That's just what they're saying. No, that's just what they're saying. They don't have to do anything because they're doing it in complete secrecy. They can do anything they damn well please.
I suppose you're right. They can do anything they damn well please.
And I remember back when this first came out. I mean, this was last fall.
And they nodded as you said that. I could hear them nodding.
I heard a chuckle in the background. I think that was Alberto Gonzalez. And last fall, there were these reports that Christiane Amanpour was being tapped as part of the NSA spying program. And that it went all the way back to the 2004 election when her husband was the surrogate for John Kerry in the debates. Her husband, isn't it Jamie Rubin?
Yes, Jamie Rubin.
Yeah, is her husband, and formerly of the Clinton administration, and a senior official in the Kerry campaign. And that, in fact, in one of the best guesses was that they were actually wiretapping her by way of trying to get to her husband, having an excuse to wiretap her husband. Now it looks, according to ABC, it looks like this was all true.
What an outrage.
It's pretty mind-boggling. It's pretty mind-boggling.
It's pretty mind-boggling. This is the kind of thing, if it comes out, that actually does bring down government.
Well, I was going to say, here's the question. Will this be, I mean, you had NBC that for 6 weeks after the Downing Street minutes broke, for a full 6 weeks, never once mentioned it. And then Tim Russert says on his show, he says, as the now famous Downing Street minutes, after 6 weeks of not mentioning it once, will this be enough to wake up the press corps, Victoria?
If it's their phones being tapped, then yes, it will.
One can only hope.
Yes,
Victoria Jones, and of course, when I speak of the press corps, I mean everybody except you, because you're doing a brilliant job. Victoria Jones, TalkRadioNews.com, 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Tell me. Don't you understand what I'm trying to say? Can't you feel the fears I'm feeling today? If the button is pushed, there's no running away. There'll be no one to save with the world in a grave. Take a look around you, boy. It's bound to scare you, boy. And you tell me.
Well, are we? Welcome back. 35 minutes past the hour. Maybe. Maybe not. Maybe not. I still have tremendous hope. I'm sorry. I remember that song from when I was a teenager. And, yeah, we were all scared to death of the Soviet Union, and where are they now? Well, actually, Vlad Putin is coming back. You know, the Russians are coming back. But in the meantime, here we have the Bushies. Number one, saying tonight George Bush is going to give his little speech, and he's going to say, oh, we need to take the National Guard down to the Mexican border. Sounds like a plan, right? No, it sounds like a failure. But this is what he's going to say. He's going to come out and say we have to use the National Guard. The fact of the matter is that most of the equipment that the National Guard has is in Iraq. This is one of the reasons why the Louisiana National Guard, the Mississippi National Guard, were not available to respond to Hurricane Katrina, because they were in Iraq. And then when they did allow those particular soldiers from those units who actually lived in those states to come back to their states to help out, they didn't bring back with them their generators and their trucks and their amphibious vehicles. All of the Louisiana National Guard's amphibious vehicles were in Iraq. Now, you ask yourself, why do they need amphibious vehicles in Iraq? After all, Iraq is not underwater. It has a couple of rivers going through. Well, that's the thing. They have had a couple of rivers going through them, and an amphibious vehicle is better than no vehicle. 20% of the 130,000 U.S. troops right now in Iraq are from the National Guard and the reserves. By the way, 561 have died in Iraq. 352 National Guard soldiers, 209 reservists. You recall back right around Christmas time of last year, Lieutenant General James Helmley, this is an active duty general, this isn't a retired guy, he's the head of the Army Reserve. He said it is, quote, rapidly degenerating into a broken force, in grave danger of being unable to meet other operational requirements, end quote. And this is who we're going to send to the Mexican border? The National Guard Bureau estimated that its non-deployed units had only 34% of their essential war-fighting equipment as of July 2005. The rest of it had been destroyed in the deserts of Iraq. The Army National Guard report this from this I believe this is the Washington Post. The Army National Guard reported that it had less than 5% of the required amount of more than 220 critical items. Less than 5%. And Bush's answer to illegal immigration, to our being overwhelmed by illegal immigration, which is by and large the consequence of Reagan pushing through an amnesty for illegal aliens in this country, basically saying, hey, we'll do it now, and therefore you can depend, we'll do it again. And then stopping the enforcement of laws against hiring illegal aliens. You're not going to hear Bush tonight say, we're going to start putting in jail those companies that hire illegal aliens. That I'm telling you, that's all he would have to do. It's a system called attrition. The right-wingers don't want to talk about it because you've got the racist fanatics, like we heard the first hour of this program with Michael Savage. You've got the racists out there freaking out, and John Gibson. You know, they're all upset, and it's good fodder for them. They're loving it. You got the corporatists who are making money hand over fist with illegal labor. I mean, you know, hey, they're illegal. What are they? Are they going to complain if we have lousy working conditions? If they don't get benefits? If they get screwed on their wages? If they don't even make the minimum wage? Are they going to complain? I don't think so. Guest workers. Yes, that's what we need. We need guest workers so that we can say to our employers, hey, you don't do what I tell you, you're out, you don't just lose a job and have to look for another one. You're out of the country. Talk about a slave-master relationship. You're not going to hear Bush talk about putting employers in prison tonight. No, you're going to hear him, what he does with everything. Turn it over to Don Rumsfeld. Turn it over to the military. Because in Bush's world, and I'm telling you, this is very much like the abused child syndrome. In Bush's world, like children who are throughout their lives are beaten up by their parents, mostly by their fathers. These kids grow up thinking that the solution to every problem is the equivalent of a beating or the threat of one. So Bush won't negotiate with countries that are behaving in ways we don't like, Iran, North Korea. Don't talk to them. Just threaten to hit them. And if they don't do what you want, hit them. And so the solution to the problem with illegal immigration? Forget about putting the employers in jail. They're the vacuum, the giant magnet that's drawing illegal. Forget about that. Because those are campaign donors, big meatpacking companies, the big agricultural companies, big manufacturing companies, the entire construction industry. That's a huge source of money for the Republicans. No, they're not going to go after them. Instead, they're going to go after our National Guard. Stick them down there in the desert. And they're not going to increase the Border Patrol, because after all, my goodness, the Border Patrol agents, they have pensions. They have benefits. They're members of a union. We can't increase the number of them working here for the government. And plus, all of this will go away in December of 2006, because the election will be over. At least in their minds. I mean, this is Bush looking as far as the next election. Pure and simple. They lay it right out in the Wall Street Journal today. It's right there in the Wall Street Journal. There is an article that it's on page A4. You think I'm being cynical? I am not. This is Jeannie Cummings, page A4, today's Wall Street Journal headline: Republicans seek to revive their activists. Subhead: amid Bush's low ratings, party's midterm plan focuses on court nominees and social issues. The lead two paragraphs: President Bush's low approval ratings are prompting the White House and Capitol Hill Republicans to design a midterm strategy. And keep in mind, this is the Wall Street Journal. This is Republicans talking to Republicans. To design a midterm strategy aimed at an unlikely set of voters, their own party activists. That helps explain why the Senate is moving on two long-block judicial nominees and why President Bush is expected to send nearly two dozen more to the Senate any day. Yes, throw some right-wing crank judges at the Democrats. And when they go, oh, then we can say, those Democrats are being obstructionists. See, the Republicans know that a good fight in politics is good politics. The Democrats, ever since they hired Bob Schrum and all these other so-called DLC, so-called consultants, to castrate the party, the Democrats are clueless. The low poll numbers are also Among reasons why votes in Congress are likely in coming months on social issues crucial to conservatives, Karl Rove, in an address today to the American Enterprise Institute, is expected to lay the foundation for an attack on Democrats, perhaps by reminding his audience that liberal leaders and ideas will return if Republicans lose control of either House of Congress. The ratings also help explain why Mr. Bush's Oval Office speech on immigration tonight, in his speech, he will toughen his talk on policing borders, possibly with National Guard help. Now, what does Governor of California, Republican Arnold Schwarzenegger, have to say about that?
I think that the Bush administration and the federal government should put up the money to create the kind of protection that the federal government is responsible to provide.
In other words, hire Border Patrol is what Arnold is saying. Put up the money and hire Border Patrol. Don't just throw National Guard people at us for a few months.
Not to use our National Guard, the soldiers that are coming back from Iraq, for instance, and they have spent now a year and a half over there, and now they're coming back. I think that we should let them go to work.
Now, yeah, let the National Guard guys go back to work. After all, they had a job. They joined the National Guard so they could work on the week, you know, so they could play warrior on the weekend, but actually have a job. What does former voting machine company president and someday presidential candidate Chuck Hagel have to say about this?
Let's approach this in a long-term way where we fix the problem. That's a short-term fix, and I'm not sure that's a very wise fix. Let's start with the fact whether we even have the capacity. What the governor is talking about, we've got 75% of the equipment of National Guards all across this country is in Iraq. We've got National Guard members on their second, third, and fourth tours in Iraq. We have stretched our military as thin as we have ever seen it in modern times. And what in the world are we talking about here, sending a National Guard that we may not have any capacity to send up to down to protect borders? That's not their role.
Yeah, and what are you going to do with the National Guard down there protecting the border if there's a major wildfire out west, or if there's an earthquake in California, or if there's flooding in New England, or if there's a hurricane that hits Florida or Louisiana or Mississippi or South Carolina or North Carolina or Maryland or Virginia? I mean, what are you going to do? What are you going to do if there's major tornadoes rolling through Tornado Alley in the Midwest? Well, I'm sorry, our National Guard is down there stopping illegal aliens. Why? Because Bush won't put into jail employers who hire them. I mean, it's really that simple. You are not going to hear Mr. Bush tonight say, we are going to start putting into jail employers who hire illegal aliens. You are not going to hear that. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Now, Daddy didn't like trouble, but if it came along, everyone that knew him knew which side that he'd be on. He never was a hero for this county's shining light, but you could always find him standing up for what he thought was right. He'd say, you've got to stand for something, or you'll fall for anything.
And welcome back, my friends.
Your own man's got a puppet on the string.
Moving toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy to the United States of America. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number, 440-8466. Bob in Westport, Washington. Hey, Bob, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I appreciate the be able to talk on your program. The first time I've called, I voted independent, Republican and Democrat, and I truly believe in We the People. My feeling on the immigration thing is that we are basically the president of Mexico is handing out maps on how to come in and break our laws.
Right.
And
by the way, if you illegally immigrate into Mexico, it's a felony and they put you in prison and deport you.
Well, and I agree, and I'm saying this, I believe in We the People. I think the majority of Americans want this immigration thing resolved so it's fair and honest, and you stand in line like everybody else. And I hope the president tells President Fox to quit the baloney, and if he put 1,000 people on his side of the border, you'll find that there would be no more illegal immigration because nobody wants to go to a Mexican jail.
Well, you see, and that's the thing. Here's the problem, though, Bob. You're assuming that the problem has to do with our border. We had, not only was that border open in 1950, it was far more open than it is right now. And we did not have an illegal immigration problem because in 1950, 35% of the American workforce was unionized, and people did not hire illegal aliens. Corporations did not hire illegal aliens, period. It just wasn't done.
Tom, I agree with you partially, but I think Eisenhower had Operation Wetback in the 50s and loaded people up and sent them back to Mexico. And I'm not saying we do that, but I'm just saying I just don't think we need to keep beating all of ourselves up collectively, the Democrats, the Republicans, or anybody. I think we're basically being told by the Mexican government to break our laws, come in here, have children, send the money back.
I agree with you that Fox is making it not just easy. He's encouraging people to come into the United States. As you know, they're publishing these little comic books, these little brochures telling people how to get across the desert and the border and all that kind of thing. But the bottom line is that nobody would be coming here from Mexico if there weren't jobs.
And I don't disagree with that at all.
So let's dry up the jobs.
I think we should send President Fox the bill out of the balance of trade for all he's doing.
Yeah, but see, that's not going to be practical. But if you go to one of the big meat packing plants in Nebraska that is actually sending guys down and negotiating with coyotes on the Mexican side of the border to bring people up to Nebraska, if you go to them and you put the CEO of that company in prison, you're going to see a whole lot fewer people coming across that
border. Well, and then that's fine. I think we should do all those things. But yeah. I think until we have the president of our southern border understand that we know he's lying to us and he's taking us for suckers, and send him the bill for this illegal problem.
Yeah, but again, Bob, you're suggesting that the problem we have is because of Vincente Fox, and it's not because of Vincente Fox. It's because of employers all across the United States who are hiring illegal aliens.
And I think that's one problem. I don't think that's the sole problem.
No, that is the problem, period.
Well,
No, it's not my opinion. You look at the reality of it. If we no longer hired illegal immigrants, they would not come here.
Well, Tom, all I'm telling you is that every rich enclave has people mowing their lawns and the roofers, and there's plenty
They're giving them jobs.
Well, I know, but I'm saying is that I think it's a multifaceted problem. I think it's not simplistic enough.
It's only
the big employers.
Think of it like drugs, like the drug problem, okay? We have tried everything to stop drugs from coming into the United States. I mean, we've spent billions of dollars on this thing. But you and I both know intuitively that if all of a sudden there was some sort of magic, they put fluoride in the water or something, and all of a sudden nobody ever wanted to smoke pot or snort cocaine, that there would be no pot or cocaine coming into this country, right?
That's awfully simplistic.
If there was absolutely no demand, I mean, if magically there was no demand, if we could legislate and say there is no demand for pot or cocaine, none would come into this country. If there was no demand for cheap labor in this country, it would not illegal labor. They would not come into this country. It's really that simple.
I think it's like that old movie that if a frog had wings, he wouldn't bump his butt so much, you know?
Okay, all righty. Well, I appreciate the conversation, Bob. I just really think it's very, very simple, and that's why the Republicans, and the Democrats for that matter, don't want to talk about it. Joe in Pittsburgh. Hey, Joe.
Good morning. How are you? Thanks for taking my call. I'm going to be at the risk of being satirical here, but I would propose if we were to go down there with the AFL-CIO and the trade unions and sign these guys up and give them union cards to where the prospective employers would have to pay them a living union wage, there'd be posses down there rounding them up right now.
Now, where's the there that you're talking about?
The border.
If the
employers that hire them here illegally had to pay them a living wage,
right,
there would be no demand for them. Plus, our government would be down there enforcing the current laws that are on the books right now.
Of course.
Instead of ignoring them.
Of course, which casts into sharp relief the real problem here, and that is that as long as there is somebody in the United States who's willing to hire an illegal alien because there's functionally no risk. I mean, when Walmart got busted for hiring a contractor that was hiring illegals, it was like, it was a small fine, so what?
Slap on the wrist. slap on the wrist, verbal reprimand.
Yeah. And most of them, it's not even a slap on the wrist. It's just, I mean, you walk into these businesses and you look around and you go, does anybody here speak English? No. And this, again, this is not one of those Michael Savage, oh my God, it's the brown people screeds. This is about, you know, countries need to deal with their own economies.
It's not a racial issue.
No, it's not. It's absolutely not.
But it isn't.
No, you're
right. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you, and well said. It's and as I said, tonight you're going to hear Bush peddling fear and peddling stupid short-term solutions instead of any kind of meaningful long-term solution that's going to really deal with the issue. In our next hour, we're going to be talking with a progressive candidate for governor of the state of Pennsylvania, Chuck Pinocchio, and a whole bunch more news here. It's amazing. What's going on? Christiane Amanpour being bugged? 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception, Tom Hartman here with you. Amazing. Dick Cheney, in his own hand, the role of vice president, this is from MSNBC. Michael Isikoff, the role of Vice President Dick Cheney in the criminal case stemming from the outing of White House critic Joseph Wilton's CIA wife is likely to get fresh attention as a result of newly disclosed notes showing that Cheney personally asked whether Wilson had been sent by his wife on a junket to Africa. Cheney's notes, written on the margins of a July 6, 2003 New York Times op-ed column by former Ambassador Joe Wilson, were included as part of a filing Friday night by prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald in the perjury and obstruction case against ex-Cheney Chief of Staff Scooter Libby. The notes, Fitzgerald said in his filing, show that Cheney and Libby were, quote, acutely focused, end quote, on the Wilson column and on rebutting his criticisms of the White House's handling of pre-Iraq war intelligence. Sure does look, in Cheney's own hand, sure does look like the senior administration official who outed Valerie Plame may have been Dick Cheney. I mean, let's see. It was either Dick Cheney, Scooter Libby, or Karl Rove. It was one of those three, and of course, all three of those people, I suppose, could be in on something and George Bush not know anything about it. Right? I mean, you know, Bush has never represented himself to the American people as all that, you know, knowledgeable about what's going on. He claims he makes decisions, but that doesn't mean he knows anything.
And I don't know. We're going to find out. The senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, Patrick Fitzgerald apparently does know. And is apparently fixing to do something about it. I mean, just think how different America would be if Al Gore had assumed the White House. I mean, he did win 5 million more votes than George W. Bush did. And he did, when they finally counted every vote in Florida, actually win the state of Florida. Unfortunately, it was 18 months after the fact. I mean, the bottom line is, had John Roberts, an attorney, volunteer attorney with the Bush-Cheney campaign, not gone down to Florida and prepped and rehearsed James Baker's lawyers on how to argue before Justice Rehnquist that the vote in Florida should be stopped because it would cause, quote, irreparable harm, end quote, to George W. Bush in the Bush versus Gore case, Gore would be president today. And you just have a sense of what it was like. Maybe you saw Al Gore Saturday Night Live.
In 2000, when you overwhelmingly made the decision to elect me as your 43rd president, I knew the road ahead would be difficult. We have accomplished so much, yet challenges lie ahead. In the last 6 years, we have been able to stop global warming. No one could have predicted the negative results of this. Glaciers that once were melting are now on the attack. As you know, these renegade glaciers have already captured parts of Upper Michigan and Northern Maine, but I assure you, we will not let the glaciers win. Right now, in the second week of May 2006, we are facing perhaps the worst gas crisis in history. We have way too much gasoline. Gas is down to 19 cents a gallon, and the oil companies are hurting. I know that I am partly to blame by insisting that cars run on trash. I am therefore proposing a federal bailout to our oil companies because, hey, if it were the other way around, you know the oil companies would help us.
Yeah, indeed. Al Gore on Saturday Night Live. Night before last, coming right out. And then, you know, it's such a juxtaposition. Here we have Dick Cheney outing a CIA operation for the, you know, this is this mean-spirited, vindictive, and on top of that, devastating to the national security. And then you've got a statesman like Al Gore, who should be president of the United States. It's just, it's enough to bring tears to your eyes.
We worked hard to save welfare, fix Social Security, and, of course, provide the free universal health care we all enjoy today. But all this came at a high cost. As I speak, the gigantic national budget surplus is down to a perilously low $11 trillion. And don't get any ideas. That money is staying in the very successful lockbox. We're not touching it. Of course, we could give economic aid to China or lend money to the Saudis again. But right now, we're already so loved by everyone in the world that American tourists can't even go over to Europe anymore without getting hugged.
There you go. Al Gore on Saturday Night Live. The middle class, meanwhile, the actual reality of the insane economic policies of the Bushies, Reaganomics Revisited. Voodoo economics. The Orlando Sentinel. Now, this is an article, you know, written for the local market. This is by April Hunt and Jerry Jackson, staff writers for the Orlando Sentinel. But it's emblematic of what's happening all across the United States. You find the exact same thing being played out over and over and over. Here in Portland, Oregon, for example, the Oregonian just reported that the average house price in Portland went up 19.5% last year. So looking now down to Orlando, the American dream is fast becoming a pipe dream for the middle class in Central Florida and throughout the Sunshine State, as new data show households with incomes of $75,000 cannot afford to buy a home. Earlier this month, Orange County Mayor Rich Crotty asked a task force to tackle what housing experts and elected officials say is a widespread crisis or fast becoming one. And then they tell a story. They say for would-be homebuyers such as Kissimmee, that's a town near Orlando, or maybe it's Kissimmee, I'm not sure, police officer Matt Oliver, the issue is already on their rented doorsteps. So here's this local cop. He says, my dad was a welder and worked hard, and we had a house growing up, said Oliver, who has been trying to buy a home for a year and a half, even though he and his fiancée earn nearly $70,000 a year combined. He said, I have a college degree, and it seems out of reach to afford a house and live a decent life. They talk another story that they tell. Grace Liaz, Executive Director of Human Resources for Orange County Public Schools, competes for teachers with areas as far away as New York, but New York helps subsidize housing for its teachers. Liaz said most teachers in Orange County, 62%, have less than 10 years' experience and are mobile, able to pick up and move more easily than long-term employees can, and the average salary of those 62% is $35,000 a year, not enough to buy a decent home. And it's not that different here in Portland, and yet I have here heard right-wing talk show hosts in local markets going off on how much teachers are getting. These teachers, they're making 30, 40 bucks an hour. If you were to consider how much they can make during their vacation time, add in benefits, off time. Oh, man. Everybody in the conservatives' mind, everybody should be making what greeters at Walmart make. After all, it's the Walmartification of America. That's a fine thing, isn't it? Isn't that the way it's supposed to be? Well, it's definitely the way the cons think it should be. And I just have to say, it is an absolute, total, screaming, terrible tragedy. And here we have now 6 years of conservative rule in the United States. Let's go back and look at the accomplishments of liberalism. This is from CJNetworks.com, turn left. The interstate highway system proposed by Roosevelt, directed by Eisenhower, a liberal Republican. The GI Bill enabled millions of Americans to get a college education. Labor laws in the 1930s. The Marshall Plan. Environmental laws. Food safety laws. Ever read The Jungle by Sinclair Lewis? Or, I'm sorry, Upton Sinclair, about the way things were before food purity laws were on the books? Dangerous stuff. Workplace safety laws, like the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, that has been solved. Workplace, to a large extent. Social Security. Economic growth. Liberalism and economic prosperity go hand in hand. Unlike these phony booms that we saw during Reagan and that you're seeing right now that are caused by cons borrowing money from future generations, giving that money to the wealthy to create a stimulus of the economy, an entirely borrowed stimulus. Real prosperity, like we saw in the 50s and 60s and 70s, back when we were paying our way. Liberal programs, the space program, the Peace Corps, the civil rights movement, the internet, the fight against totalitarianism, the Tennessee Valley Project, the women's right to vote, universal public education, the National Weather Service, public health. 16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And they look at you like they don't speak your language. And you're living at the bottom of a well. And you've swallowed all the awful, bloody secrets.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Chuck Pinocchio is with us, our Taking Back America segment. Chuck Pinocchio, a Democrat for the United States Senate, running against Bob Casey in the great state of Pennsylvania. Hey, Chuck, welcome to the program.
Hey, terrific, Tom. Thanks for having me.
We should note your website, chuck2006.com, very easy to find. Chuck, on your website, you note that Bob Casey's lead over Rick Santorum in the polls has dropped from 16 points down to 6 points. You suggest this is because Chuck Casey is taking Republican-like positions?
Precisely. More to the point is that people are finally beginning to pay attention to the fact that he's doing that. Not enough are paying attention. But the fact is, Tom, is that I've never experienced or even imagined in America the kind of systematic orchestration of a race as mm-hmm. I've experienced here in Pennsylvania. It's really astonishing. It's a great learning experience. But you know what? That's going to make our victory tomorrow a people's campaign.
Well, what you're seeing, Chuck, we're talking with Chuck Pinocchio. He's running for the Democratic nomination for United States Senate in the state of Pennsylvania. The primary is tomorrow.
That's right.
May 16th. What you're seeing, Chuck, is the machine. You're seeing the Democratic Party machine in action.
Yeah.
And really, that's a pretty cool thing, because if you're the nominee, you're going to have that machine behind you.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the machine, though, that is just sucking up corporate dollars and selling out workers' rights, environmental rights, fair trade, health care, schools. I mean, really, it's just...
Then get control of it.
Yes, absolutely.
Take it over.
Hey, that's who I am, Tom. I am a fighter, and you know that. We've crossed paths a few times. I come from a social justice background, 33 years of organizing, and I know what it's like to work with and for people. I'm a union organizer, a former, and a union member.
Yeah.
I fought for health care, wages, and I worked for 4 U.S. senators and a member of Congress, Ron Dellums. And fought for men and women in uniform. I've got the experience that this is a race that is absolutely, it's a crystallization of so much that we have that we can accomplish. We're in a crisis period. Now is the time to speak out. Now is the time to push the envelope. And Pennsylvanians are responding absolutely positively to living wage. And you turned me on to that, Tom. I have to give you full credit there. Universal health care, world-class education, a sane foreign policy that actually restores diplomacy. You know, this is an astonishing thing. People recognize that we are ripe for change. We're going to win tomorrow because people are waking up.
How's it going, Chuck? You've been traveling all around Pennsylvania in this primary campaign. You're going up against a guy who is the candidate of the machine. Bills himself as a so-called pro-life Democrat.
Yeah, so-called pro-life. He supports the war, of course. He supports death penalty unconditionally. No, this is not a person who is entirely consistent. And the fact is that Bob Casey is as right-wing as you can get above the Mason-Dixon line and be considered a credible politician. I'm just dumbstruck at how part of the right this guy has actually moved. He came out for Alito. He supported the Schiavo bill. He doesn't support separation church and state. My gosh, privacy rights, Tom.
And he's a Democrat. How did Bob Casey then become the presumptive nominee of the Democratic Party machine in the state of Pennsylvania?
Name recognition, his father's name. His father
his
was
father
a popular two-term governor.
Former governor.
That's correct. Listen, this is Chuck Schumer's deal. Chuck Schumer decided that this was the place to make a mark and to adopt the DLC strategy.
That's a tragedy. You know, Harry Truman was so right when he said that if the American people are given a choice between voting for a Republican or a Democrat who behaves like a Republican, they'll vote for the Republican every time.
And
I would say the same is true, although the Republicans on the other side, the Republicans have figured that out.
If people
are given a choice between a Republican between a Democrat or a Republican who talks like a Democrat, they would choose the Democrat every time. I mean, people want somebody who's consistent and true to their party, and you don't see Republican-like Republicans over there. I mean, you know, if Olympia Snowe is no liberal. I'm sorry. Lincoln Chafee is no liberal. It's amazing that this happens in the Democratic Party. So we have 1 minute. Chuck 2006, the website. What do you want our listeners in Pennsylvania to do, Chuck Pinocchio, in the next 24 hours?
Just jump into the state. I mean, come in and help us with GOTV. Get out the vote. If you're within driving distance, come to the state. Get literature out. Get signs out. This is people taking it back. That's what this is all about, Tom. This is a great chance for people to jump in. If anybody knows anybody in Pennsylvania, a registered Democrat, have them vote. Have them contact 10 other people. Go to our website, chuck2006.com, and you will be excited. This is an extraordinary race that we're running. It's a ground game. It's internet. It's grassroots. We're going to win this, Tom. We're going to blow away the establishment.
Any early polls, Chuck?
Polls?
Just right. Curious.
Yeah,
How you doing?
Well, very well. I thought we were wrapping up there. Zogby's done a wonderful, wonderful poll. It's the only scientific poll, and it shows me beating Casey when people find out where I stand, and it shows me beating Santorum when people find out where I stand. These are popular issues. These are majoritarian positions, all the ones we talked about. Pennsylvania is not conservative.
There you go. At least the Democrats in Pennsylvania are not conservative.
That's right.
Chuck Pinocchio, Democrat for the United States Senate. His website, Chuck2006.com. Chuck, thanks for being with us.
Tom, absolutely. Best to you and to your listeners.
Thank you. And ditto, and good luck on taking back Pennsylvania. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program.
I get so lost sometimes. Days pass and this emptiness fills my heart.
And welcome back for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 26 minutes before the hour. Bill in Chicago, Illinois on the line. Hey, Bill, thanks for calling the program. What's up?
Hey, it's
getting hard to get through to you. I'm giving your site out to too many people, obviously.
Well, you made it, Bill. What's on your mind today?
Listen, I initially called about immigration, but that was about three topics ago, and I want to tell you I agree with you on most all of them. I want to know, who's the person that comes up with these inflation rate numbers that they come up with? Because they aren't anywhere near reality, let me tell you.
Yeah, no, they're obviously not. And all you have to do is ask any American family, you know. And then that's the point that was made, by the way. In fact, it was in the headline of that story that I was sharing with you earlier. I don't know where it is now. But anyhow, that home prices have gone up almost 100% and salaries have been flat.
Since
Bush came into office.
It's just
in the Orlando area. Anyway.
And I wanted to share with you my mind's eye perfect photograph. Rove and Cheney both being taken out in handcuffs.
There you go. You know, to paraphrase Joe Wilson. You know.
That's a champagne day.
Yes. Yeah.
But indeed. I think about the immigration, though, is with this National Guard thing. I mean, what an obvious ploy this is. You're going to put people down there who have no training in this, have no idea what the area is like, what the topography is like.
But they're carrying guns. It'll make a great photo opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. And, of course, it's nice because they're in these nice units that you can immediately move out the day after the election, right?
Right.
You know,
there,
and you don't
there you
have
go.
To, My thing here is, I'm a retired police detective in Chicago, and listen, in my experience, when emergency operations have had to have an influx of manpower, what they do is they hire like in the border guards. Somebody gave me a figure one time of 5,500 border guards for the country.
Yeah, it's not a whole lot. That makes sense. I've heard the numbers, but it's in that neighborhood. Yeah,
and that's to cover three shifts a day, 7 days a week.
Right, I mean, and that includes Canada and Mexico.
Yeah, what
and
do they have
and
to
down
there?
In Florida, they've got some of these guys, you know, looking at the keys and all that kind of thing. Yeah.
I mean, what do they got? 50 guys on the border then at any given time, or I mean,
I think it's more like 400 or 500 is the total on the Mexican border.
But it's not near enough.
No, I mean, no. On the one hand, on the other hand, the fact of the matter is that 30, 40, 50 years ago, there was nobody on the border.
And
we didn't have people pouring across the border because we had a strong unionized workforce and people didn't hire illegal aliens. It just wasn't done.
It's got to be a multi-pronged attack on this problem. But the thing I was getting to with the hiring new people, we have a problem in this country, obviously, with training people. We haven't been able to train an Iraqi army in 3 years.
Yeah.
I don't know what.
Well, it's not us. It's the Bushies.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's
Bushies.
What I mean. But the thing with that is what we do, what most emergency operations did when you needed an influx of manpower was you created an on-the-job training program.
Right.
And you hired whatever you needed, 25,000
The Border Patrol
people.
Has that, Bill.
Oh, yeah?
The Border Patrol has that. They have a program. They bring people. They routinely bring people in. I mean, there's attrition. People die. I mean, occasionally they do. The problem is George W. Bush does not want to increase the Border Patrol because those are good government jobs that have pensions, have benefits, have retirements, that have health insurance. He doesn't want to pay all that stuff. Instead, he's going to get the guys who back before he came into office were gullible enough or actually back then patriotic enough to say, you know, I'll sign up for the weekend, to be a weekend warrior and show up from time to time for my week or two a year.
Right.
And if there's a national emergency, I will, with honor and with pleasure, I'll show up and help out in time of a national emergency. These guys had no idea they were going to end up doing 2-3 terms in Iraq.
Oh, absolutely.
And they certainly did not sign up to become Border Patrol down in Mexico.
Yeah,
it's absolutely crazy.
Bill, thanks
a lot for the call.
Okay.
I got to move along. Good to hear from you, though. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
Allison in Seattle, you're welcome. Allison in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Allison.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am great. What's up?
I was in Portland a couple of weeks ago and got to hear your local show, and we're just so proud to have you in the Northwest. I can't claim you for Seattle, but, you know, we are Northwest. So.
Well, this is, you know, Talk 1090 in Seattle is one of my favorite affiliates. And
yeah, we're looking forward to having you up here next time. I think you're coming up soon. So
yeah, I'll be there on the 10th of June, I think it is.
Yeah. Well, I was glad to hear that you played the piece on Al Gore. I happened to catch that. It was a total surprise that he was on Saturday Night Live. In fact, I think when you first saw him on there, you thought he was Daryl Hammond doing the impression because he does such a good one. It was a really interesting piece, and I heard on, I was listening to Don Imus this morning on MSNBC, and Monica Crowley, who I'm certainly no fan of, mentioned that piece, and she said she thought that was his announcement for the presidency, for running for the presidency. And
let us hope.
Exactly. And ever since you started playing his speech, the one that he sounds so so good on, so commanding and forceful, I've been watching to see what he's been doing, and I have his website and so forth. But I'm just hoping that, as I think you've mentioned in the past, that he doesn't come along too soon, because you know what the Republicans do. They want to choose who we're running against.
And, oh, yeah. Yeah, and they will try and take him down all over again.
Exactly.
Hey, Allison, thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you for all your work. We just love you.
You're welcome. Thank you. It's very nice to hear from you. And a little bit more of Al Gore on Saturday Night Live.
There are some of you who would like to spend our money on some made-up war. To you, I say, what part of lockbox don't you understand? What if there's a hurricane or a tornado? Unlikely, I know, because of the anti-hurricane and tornado machine I was instrumental in helping develop. But what if? What if the scientists are right and one of those giant glaciers hits Boston? That's why we have the lockbox. As for immigration, solving that came at a heavy cost, and I personally regret the loss of California. However, the new Mexifornian economy is strong, and El Presidente Schwarzenegger is doing a great job.
There you go. And asking El Presidente Schwarzenegger what he thinks about George W. Bush's plan to go in and send the National Guard down to watch the border, El Presidente Schwarzenegger is not all that enthusiastic about it.
I think that the Bush administration and the federal government should put up the money to create the kind of protection that the federal government is responsible to provide. Not to use our National Guard, the soldiers that are coming back from Iraq, for instance, and they have spent a year and a half over there, and now they're coming back. I think that we should let them go to work.
Yeah, there you go. Let them go back to their jobs. After all, they had jobs before they got shipped off to Iraq. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary.
Hi, Tom. Has anybody ever thought that just the innate sense of fairness of the American people, that Al Gore not only should be the candidate, but should be the president?
Well, Al Gore is the only, he's the best president of the United States who was never president of the United States. I mean, he won in 2000. It's just that simple. I mean, you go back and you read the New York Times story after the race, and it's funny. Every time I talk about this, I get all these emails from people. You can find it on you pay for the archives, I guess, in the New York Times, but it's out there. It's all over the place, and they buried it in the 17th paragraph. You know, the story in the New York Times starts out saying, if Al Gore and if the original request that Al Gore had made to recount four counties was followed, then George W. Bush would still be president of the United States. And they quack, quack, quack about that for like 17 paragraphs. And then they get down in the 17th paragraph. They say, but if every vote in the state was counted, Al Gore won by any measure, whether you count nipple chads or not, hanging
That's
chads or
absolutely
not,
right.
Intent of the voter or not, any measure, by any measure, Al Gore won Florida if you count all the votes in the state. And the last I looked, the way that we elect somebody is by counting all the votes in a state. So, but they, you know,
not by this crowd. Not by this crowd.
No, not at all. And later on, when Hal Raines, or I think it was Hal Raines, one of the executives at the New York Times, was asked, why did you bury that in the 17th paragraph? He said, well, because it just came out a couple months after 9/11, and we felt that it was important that George W. Bush not look like an illegitimate president, which, of course, implies that he is an illegitimate president, which is true. Yeah, George W. Bush is illegitimate as president of the United States. And he knew it then, and he knows it now.
Yes, and by the way, well said. The arrogance of these tax cuts is just sticking in my craw again. These tax cuts, when the first round, not even these, the first round could have funded Social Security for the next 75 years. This crowd just isn't anti-union. I think they're anti-people in a lot of ways.
Well, they're anti-middle class, and the reason why...
Well, that's anti-people.
They're pro-themselves. The reason why these guys don't want there to be a strong middle class in the United States, and all you have to do is look back to the explosion of the conservative movement in the 60s and 70s, at the height of the American middle class. The American middle class, in the 230-some-odd-year history of the United States, had never been stronger than during the 1960s and 1970s, economically stronger. And what comes along with economic strength, where you don't have to worry that you might upset your employer because you can always find another job. You don't have to worry that you might upset your university because you can always get admitted to another college. And what comes along with the strength of a middle class is the willingness to stand up to authority. And the conservatives looked at that and they said, my God, this is the end of America. We cannot have, you know, students out on the street, women talking about equal rights, people marching, people talking about social justice, African Americans saying that they want to have, you know, civil rights, just the whole thing. And just to the conservatives, it just looked like our entire society was unraveling. And they were like, quick, let's get rid of this middle class. We just can't have a middle class like this. It'll destroy America after all. And, it would destroy an aristocracy, a kleptocracy. It is called, however, democracy. But that's not what the Bushies want. The Bushies are not interested in democracy. They're interested in oligarchy. I'll tell you about Christiane Amanpour after this, right after this break. Thank you for the call, Gary. Good to hear from you. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I ain't lived forever, but I've lived enough. And I've learned to be gentle, and I've learned to be tough. I've found only two things that last till the end. One is your heroes, the other's your friends.
And welcome back to The Pill That Will Help You Escape the Matrix. Tom Hartman here with you. Coming up on 9 minutes before the hour. Back in January of this year, this was 5 months ago, Andrea Mitchell, NBC reporter, asked James Risen of the New York Times, the guy who first broke the story on the NSA wiretapping, asked if Christiane Amanpour had been listened in on. It was up on the NBC website for a day or so, and then NBC scrubbed it off their website, and Andrea Mitchell never talked about it again, and nobody had the bad manners to ask her about it. After all, she's the wife of Alan Greenspan. She's a big shot. She's very powerful. Who wants to mess with the star? There very much is a star system in the news nowadays. Well, it did, however, get out. And so David Ensor of CNN asked the NSA, are you guys spying on Christiane Amanpour? And he received an official response. Now, here's what's interesting. First of all, I'd like you to remember that the NSA, and the CIA for that matter, are forbidden by law from spying on Americans. The agency that's supposed to spy on Americans is the FBI. The FBI has not only the right, but the responsibility to spy on Americans, with a warrant, of course, but still, it's the FBI that's supposed to be doing this. So, and in fact, it was the FBI that Richard Nixon was using, for example, to spy on his political enemies. So I just find this official response from the NSA to be fascinating because it is so specific. It goes on, here's the message. He says, I'm told considerable man hours today went into making sure the answer to CNN would be accurate. A senior U.S. intelligence official tells us that our colleague Christiane Amanpour has never been targeted by the National Security Agency. And neither has any other CNN journalist. Okay, well, this raises the question, has Christiane Amanpour been targeted by any other? I mean, you know, she's not been targeted by the NSA. Has the CIA looked into her? Has the FBI looked into her? And for that matter, why say just no other CNN journalist? Why not say no other journalist? What about ABC, CBS, NBC journalists? Was Dan Rather being snooped on? Keep in mind, Richard Nixon had an enemies list. Dan Rather was on his enemies list. Back to David Ensor's report. He says, now, the NSA, as you know, is the eavesdropping intelligence agency of the U.S. government's big ear, and from time to time, the official says wiretaps overseas or other intercepts turn out to include Americans, or what they call U.S. persons, which includes people who work for U.S. companies. It does so inadvertently. Now, here it's also specifically talking about eavesdropping. What about sorting through their phone records? I mean, there's so many different issues here. Jack in Monterey, California, listening on KRXA?
Jack. Yeah, that's correct. Thanks, Tom. I just had a couple of comments on the immigration issue. You had last week on your show, you discussed an article regarding Europe and what's happening with our immigration issue here in the United States, and they talked about and how until it finally got to a point where there was parity among the European nations.
Right, they were looking at Spain and Ireland.
Right, and until that happened, essentially people were crossing borders no matter what they did to
keep
them out.
As long as employers were willing to hire them.
And I recall the article also stated that the difference in salaries for the average family in Mexico was $6,000 compared to $30,000 in this country.
Yes.
And my comment is that being the case, I don't think they can build a fence high enough to keep people out.
No, you can't. I'll tell you, I lived on the East German border for a while. And you can, I mean, literally, you wake up in the morning, particularly in the winter, you wake up in the morning and hear the explosions hear the explosions as the ground is thawing or freezing and it sets off the landmines. Now that was, they had barbed wire chain link fence wire, you know, with barbed wire embedded in it that went up about 16, 18 feet with then razor wire across the top. There were two of these things. They were separated by about a 20-foot area, 20, maybe 30-foot area that had sand in it. And then there was a car track on the East German side, on the far side where the Border Patrol went. About every 300-400 yards, there was a tower that went up 150 feet in the air, and there were two guys up in those towers with machine guns. In fact, we used to walk along the fence, and they'd follow us with their guns. And all along that sand, you know, number one, it was sand so they could see if anybody had crossed it. Number two, it was filled with landmines. Plus, they put landmines on the West German side because they built the fence back about 50 feet into East Germany. So they had 50 feet of East Germany still on the West German side of the fence, and they put landmines there. Now, that's what it took to stop people from moving across the border. And I just don't think we're going to do that with Mexico.
Well, and I don't think that's the answer to the problem in the end, no matter what. And my attitude is that we need some kind of parity between the nations, and if that's
so, let's all earn $20,000 a year or $12,000 a year.
Well, we had a caller on our local show, and I mentioned that to your screener when I called. I don't know how accurate, but he mentioned that Mexico is the ninth largest economy in the world. And
no,
if that's
it's not.
The case,
it's not.
Yeah,
it might be in terms of population. Well, actually, they're exporting a lot of oil. Frankly, I don't know. But what you have to do is you have to take the economy and divide it by the number of people. I mean, it's just there's no way it's going to happen. No way it's going to happen, Jack. And plus, you've got this oligarchy down there. Coming up on the next Tom Hartman program, Betsy Leonard Wright is here with her new book, The Color of Wealth in Communications. And Jeffrey Feldman from Frame Shop is open and is going to tell us about Bush's three lies on immigration and how we should respond. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.